case on calendar for argument is United States versus Tiedemann. Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Daniel Yadrin on behalf of Mr. Tiedemann. I will try to keep track of my own time for rebuttal. For 2 minutes. Obviously, this case presents a lot of issues. Unless the court wishes to begin elsewhere, I would like to focus on three. First, revoking supervised release for failure to provide a phone's passcode violates the Fifth Amendment. And second and third, the polygraph and internet access conditions violate the Constitution and Section 3583. Punishing Mr. Tiedemann for refusing to state his password violated his right against self-incrimination, as stated by this court in Antelope. This court was clear, a person cannot have supervised release revoked because he declines to provide information that he reasonably believes would be incriminating. And again, it is from his perspective under the United States Supreme Court in Hybl. And so here's what Mr. Tiedemann knew when his probation officer asked for his passcode. The last time he gave his phone to his probation officer, it resulted in the underlying charges here. And next, that phone contained child erotica, which, although not illegal in itself, this court and every other federal court of appeals to address the matter has held as relevant in child pornography prosecutions. So based on that, he reasonably feared giving up his passcode, which the government does not dispute as testimonial, would lead to new charges.
What about the Hullen case? I think there we said the privilege does not extend to a proceeding to revoke supervised release. Why doesn't that foreclose your claim?
Because Hebert and Minnesota against Murphy from the Supreme Court became first. And so Hewlin addressed a different scenario that actually would apply in the vast majority of situations. I acknowledge our rule under Hebert and Minnesota against Murphy is the exception. But Hewlin says for the mine run of supervised release conditions, those do not have a reasonable likelihood of creating new charges. Where I'm living, where I'm working, even if I fail a drug test, that does not lead to new charges. And so Hewlin held, in line with Minnesota against Murphy, that does not implicate the Fifth Amendment. But Hebert squarely held that it was improper for the district court to revoke supervised release, given the compulsion to provide information that he reasonably feared would be incriminating. Hewlin can't overrule that.
But I thought Mr. Tiedemann said that there was nothing illegal on my phone, and the government has conceded that child erotica is not criminal, the possession of. So why was there even if we accept your arguments, why would there be any likelihood of future prosecution under these circumstances?
Under Hebert, Your Honor, we look at what the defendant was doing, not just what he said. I think any person having an agent of the state asking for a passcode to a phone that contains something that this court and others have held is on the borderline between child erotica, which is lawful, and child pornography, which is not, would say there's nothing for you to see on there. Indeed, this court and other courts have noted it is a six-factor balancing test distinguishing child erotica from child pornography that has spawned decades of litigation. This was recognized actually first by this court in the Ween case from the 80s. So someone in Mr. Tiedemann's position on a 15-year term of supervised release stemming from the last time he gave his probation officer his phone reasonably feared, I'm not sure where this is going to go.
I'm not sure how we can – I mean, how do you explain the drug test cases? Because there the defendant or the supervisee could arguably say, well, I'm afraid of taking the drug test because it could reasonably – if I fail it, wouldn't that be a criminal violation?
Not at least under federal law, Your Honor. It would definitely lead to the revocation of a supervised release under standard conditions. But it is not a crime under federal law, at least that I'm aware of, to test positive for using marijuana. If Your Honors have no further questions on the revocation,
I just wanted to ask you, do you agree that the exclusionary rule does not apply in the revocation context?
Certainly not, Your Honor. I do acknowledge that's a tough row for us, but mm-hmm. This court is not foreclosed from holding that. If you look at the Hebert case, which I may have misused earlier, this court held forgive me, that the exception for when an officer knows someone is on supervised release does not apply. It did not foreclose all exceptions. And this court has also
held. But do you have a case that says the exclusionary rule or that has applied the exclusionary rule in the revocation context?
Not in the revocation context. The best case we have, Your Honor, is Orhaghe, and forgive me on the pronunciation, and that says that administrative tribunals, to which the Supreme Court has compared revocation proceedings, are still required to exclude evidence that was obtained by deliberate violations of the Fourth Amendment or by conduct a reasonable officer should know is in violation of the Constitution. And here, as the government does not dispute, the unique fact here is that the probation officer actually violated the terms of supervision by not having a reasonable suspicion. None of the other cases cited by the government have that wrinkle. So on the uniquely invasive terms of supervision, the cleanest issue here is the polygraph test. It was a violation of Article 3 for the court to delegate its judicial power for the probation officer not to only decide how often Mr. Tiedemann would be subjected to polygraph tests, but whether, if at all. And again, if you look at ER 8, this is not a condition that says Mr. Tiedemann shall be subjected to polygraph tests a certain number of times, and that's up to the probation officer. It says this may happen post-treatment. I leave that to the probation officer.
How is that punishment, though? How is that a significant deprivation of liberty to allow a probation officer to administer polygraph exams?
It is certainly more invasive than doing a urinary drug test, which again just tells the probation officer whether or not you've used drugs, to strap into a polygraph test and answer any question under the sun from an agent of the state with no guarantee that it won't be used in future prosecution. That is punishment. And again, going back to Stevens, I believe it's footnote 3, which canvasses other circuits on how they've tried to draw this line on the Article 3 question. And it notes two cases from the First Circuit. You have York, which actually said there was no delegation on a polygraph question because the district court made sure to say, post-treatment, you shall be subjected to polygraph tests. And I believe there was a number two. And it contrasts that with another, and forgive me for looking at my notes here, Melendez-Santana, where there is a delegation problem when the condition, like here, merely says the defendant may be subjected to tests, and it's up to the probation officer to decide if and when.
But Stevens also talked about testing in the context of a treatment program. Why isn't the polygraph here to facilitate post-treatment rehabilitation? Why wouldn't it fit into that category as opposed to the ones that you're describing that's completely outside of treatment altogether?
Because under the condition at issue here, the district court already provided properly for polygraph tests as part of a treatment program. So at ER 8, it starts talking about you shall participate in a treatment program.
But the model also talks about post-treatment polygraph testing in order to maintain compliance with the treatment program's objectives. And so, I mean, I think Stevens even recognizes a potential greater degree of discretion in that context that may be apt here.
Still, the district court decided what qualified as treatment. So again, at ER 8, the district court says you shall do a treatment program, and that treatment program will contain physiological testing, which under this court's precedence is polygraph testing. And then it goes on and says when treatment is over, the PO may subject you to polygraph tests. That goes beyond treatment. And even in Stevens, I recognize the magic words treatment or containment model were not used in describing post-drug treatment drug tests. But this court still held it's no answer that the probation officer just wants to make sure that the defendant is keeping up on the progress he made in treatment. It is still a delegation of Article 3. It would still be a delegation of Article 3 power.
Counsel, do you have a case that has found a delegation problem with respect to polygraph testing?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize. This was not in the briefing. From the Fifth Circuit, we have United States against Vega Santos. That's at 122 F4th 571. The Second Circuit came close to suggesting it be required on these facts. There's a little more nuance in this case. That's Villa Fane Lozado. That's 973 F3rd 147. And again, the First Circuit case in York, which is cited in Stevens, that does not come out for the defendant, but the rule it establishes, we would welcome. Moving on to the internet access condition, the trend is clear. An increasing number of courts of appeals and state appellate courts have held it is simply not possible to function in today's society without some guaranteed and monitored access to the internet. It's increasingly hard to even find a job in the modern economy without at least some guaranteed, if monitored, access to the internet. And this court is not foreclosed by precedent from holding that this was an abuse of discretion. And that is so because there are legal arguments raised here that were not raised in Wells. Reardon was on plain error. So you have the delegation issue, which maps very neatly with the discussion we've just had about polygraph testing. You have the government's concession that there was no express finding about why this was necessary in this case and why some other less intrusive restriction would not be feasible.
What would be a less intrusive restriction? Because, I mean, the crime of conviction involved use of the internet. And so I think the case is, I mean, you're right to point out Reardon and Wells because I think they support the government's position. The cases are very careful about internet access when it doesn't involve the crime of conviction in particular. But here you have that, and on top of it, you had Mr. Tiedemann actually violating his terms of supervision. And so why is it an abuse of discretion here to have that restriction at the moment subject to potential modification down the road?
There's two questions there, and I want to make sure I get to them both.
Okay.
We have the broader legal issue you're talking about when this court says you can put this sort of restriction on internet access if it's essential to the offense. That may have been an exception 20 years ago when this court first announced it. In modern day crime, that is an exception that is swallowing the rule. I am hard pressed to think of a case that comes through our office where use of the internet, even if it just be WhatsApp, wasn't essential for commission of the offense. So if this court really means that, there are going to be a lot of criminal defendants who cannot find work when they are trying to be rehabilitated. Even contractors at our house, when they were redoing a kitchen, needed constant access to a camera phone to figure out what was going on, what was at Home Depot. And then on the facts of this case, Mr. Tiedemann has not yet had a chance to be on supervised release with a monitored device. And so as trial counsel was explaining below, it's very possible this whole situation would have been avoided if he had access to a monitored device to do the basic acts of life. Indeed, the record shows some of the device was being used to help his mom with housing. So that temptation is removed if he knows he is on a monitored device.
Counsel, but you're also challenging the monitoring condition, aren't you?
With respect to hard disk monitoring, not with respect to internet monitoring. With respect to internet monitoring, we would urge this court to adopt Judge Chhabra's order from the Northern District. He refuses to impose these conditions anymore in child pornography cases.
Can I ask you about that? I mean, I do have a little bit of a concern with the monitoring condition as being overbroad because it's not clear to me whether it's only limited to internet-related monitoring, but, you know, sort of off-site monitoring as well, which came up in our Quinson case. I know we're reviewing this under plain error review, but is it your position that this was plainly erroneous because of Quinson, or what cases would you say it's plainly erroneous under?
Under Quinson, Your Honor, and I do want to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, but I'm happy to expound upon that if you wish.
All right, you're already down to 1 minute and 46 seconds, so we'll save that for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Nicholas Pilchak for the United States. I'll start where my colleague did. Although before I do, I certainly think the exclusionary rule does not apply to supervised release revocations. That was this court's holding in Hebert or Hebert. I think this panel is bound by that decision. I don't think there is room for the egregiousness exception that Mr. Tiedemann is trying to urge this court to create. But even if there was, this is not the case for that. The search by probation, based on a reliable tip here, given its long history with Mr. Tiedemann, was not a suspicionless search. It certainly was not an egregious violation of his rights. So there's no need to build out a new exception to the clear rule that was enunciated in Hebert. To turn to the Fifth Amendment issue, Mr. Tiedemann seems to believe that there should be no negative consequences for an invocation of Fifth Amendment rights for somebody on supervised release. But of course, Fifth Amendment law generally allows for all sorts of negative consequences for someone who chooses to invoke their Fifth Amendment rights, massive civil liability, reputational consequences, all sorts of things that can happen against someone. This court's case law is clear that one of the things that can happen is a revocation of supervised release for someone who's required to answer questions on supervised release. In the reply, Mr. Tiedemann makes a very clever argument to try to distinguish Hulin, where this court said straight up, the Fifth Amendment does not apply in supervised release revocation context, which is what we have here. And he says, yes, that's just because Hulin was talking about the kinds of admissions that couldn't lead to a new crime. First of all, that's not what this court said in Hulin. In that decision, it was applying a very careful analysis that said, this question turns on the nature of the proceeding. That's what the decision said. And in Hulin, because a supervised release revocation is not a new criminal prosecution, the Fifth Amendment simply doesn't apply. So whatever was going through Mr. Tiedemann's mind when he declined to answer that question that he was required to, which is, what is the password to your unauthorized phone that we've just found in your car? He did not have a Fifth Amendment right that he could enforce against the government in a supervised release revocation. And this concept that rule only applies when your answer couldn't lead to a new crime is totally unworkable and I think would create massive problems for the supervised release system. Right now, I think the Ninth Circuit has something like 23,000 people under supervision, according to its annual report. Every one of those people is required for probation to come out and do a home visit. And I think every time probation comes to do a home visit, one of the first questions they ask is, do you have a gun at the house for their safety, for the supervisee's safety? And if every person on supervised release, all 23,000, has the absolute right to say, I can't answer that question because I have a Fifth Amendment right, I think we have real problems for the entire system of federal supervised release. And I think under Hulin, what's required is that defendants like Mr. Tiedemann, when they violate it and are asked a question, they're required to answer about their violation. They have to answer, and they don't have a Fifth Amendment right that they can enforce.
If they answer, and that answer is used in a subsequent criminal prosecution, doesn't that implicate the Fifth Amendment?
And that's a separate issue. At that point, you know, if the probation officer had found child pornography on Mr. Tiedemann's unauthorized phone in his car, and the government had tried to prosecute him for that in a new criminal prosecution, I think he would have a Fifth Amendment right that he could assert then, and there probably would be some really nasty suppression and Castigar litigation around that. And, you know, I think that's a different context under Hulin because it's a new criminal prosecution where his Fifth Amendment right would survive. So I think that's the distinction under this court's case law. And that's why the Fifth Amendment needn't concern the case here, or concern the court here. I want to address one of the concessions that Mr. Tiedemann said the government made in its reply brief because I don't think it's accurate. I don't want the court to get confused about it. There are three conditions he's challenging in his seven conditions that he's challenging overall for a supervised release about software updates, cloud storage, and encryption. And in his reply brief, he says the government agrees that this court should send the case back down to the district court to modify the conditions to say he can only violate those conditions if he uses those techniques with the intent to evade monitoring somehow, to get out from under probation knowing what he's doing. That's not our position. I think that would be a very unworkable standard. Our position is the same thing that the district court said, which is Mr. Tiedemann can violate those conditions if he intentionally uses the technique. So if he does, again, what he's already done, which is use an encrypted cloud storage app, he used one called Mega before, which is for storing photographs and videos, if he intentionally uses that technique again, that's a clear-cut violation without having to get into did he intend to evade anyone by doing that. So I just wanted to clean that up. On the delegation point, I agree with the import of this court's question. I don't think a polygraph test is judicial punishment, meaning that the court doesn't need to trouble itself about delegation issues because telling the probation officer, this gentleman may be subject to polygraphs, which, by the way, everyone agrees he can be subject to polygraphs when he's in his formal treatment program. The only question is after conclusion of treatment. I think the way the court's order is written here at ER 8 complies with this court's case law. And I think that there's no basis for finding that a polygraph examination, which is really part of a much more iterative treatment process about have you been keeping up with your requirements, how are things going? I also don't know that the answers to a polygraph would directly lead to a violation in the same way that Mr. Tiedemann concedes a dirty drug test would. And so I think for all those reasons, there's no basis to conclude the polygraph requirement is a punishment, meaning an exercise of the district court's judicial authority. So there's no delegation problem.
And if we didn't agree with you about the punishment aspect of it, why do you think this condition is consistent with our prior case law?
Well, it's because even if the court finds that it can be punishment, I think the way that it's worded here is clearly part of what was described in the district court as the containment model, which is a collaborative process to ensure that Mr. Tiedemann is rehabilitated and complying with his conditions. And because the district court said, you may be subject to this. It didn't say you'll be subject if probation decides, but you may be subject to probation's discretion, which may be a distinction without a difference, but I think there's room to find that wording complies with this court's case law. Unless the court has other questions about that or any of the other conditions, I don't think this is a good case to roll off any of the conditions in Mr. Tiedemann's case. He was a diagnosed psychopath and pedophile. He was diagnosed with sexual recidivism risk that was above average and a high risk of general violence. I think the conditions are all justified.
I do have a question about the monitoring condition.
Yes.
And I know we're reviewing this for plain error, but why doesn't this run afoul of Kinzon? The condition says monitoring of all computer use and cellular data. I'm not sure what that means. I mean, does that also encompass non-internet-based monitoring?
I think if you focus on that sentence, it probably does limit itself to internet-based communications and not what Mr. Tiedemann's counsel describes as like a hard disk review or an every keystroke review of using a local computer. And so I think there's room, if this court is troubled by that, to say that's how we construe that condition because the language would cover it. But I think there is, I mean, you also could read the condition the other way, and I would suspect that's how the district court was reading it.
Say that part again.
I think it's possible to read the condition as comprehensive monitoring, meaning, so Mr. Tiedemann, in his original case of conviction in this case, had communications on his device that were about kidnapping children and doing terrible things to them and then disposing of their bodies. I think if those were internet communications, they would hit the monitoring net under the cellular data or communications sentence that Your Honor just quoted. Mm-hmm. If it was journaling, which is how Mr. Tiedemann described it in his brief, where he's just typing to himself in a Word document on his hard drive, it's possible the monitor would never know about that. I think the fairest way to read the condition and the way the district court likely had it in mind when it was imposing it is that it would cover both situations. But I think under Kinzon, if this court wanted to limit it to the cellular data and communications and miss out on those private journaling keystrokes,
then we could construe it in that limiting fashion.
I think that would be fair.
Okay.
All that said, unless the court has other questions, I think we're prepared to submit. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Your Honors, this court's decision in Antelope and the Supreme Court in Murphy offer a solution to the government's parade of horribles on wreaking havoc to supervised release, and that is you offer immunity from future prosecution to a supervisee if you're going to ask them questions they fear could lead to future charges. Again, that was stated by this court in Antelope and the Supreme Court in Murphy. Moving on to polygraph examinations, there is no need to create a circuit split on whether or not this constitutes punishment and what is the test for determining whether or not a district court has impermissibly delegated Article III power. Again, you have at least the First and Fifth Circuits squarely holding to the contrary. Third, there was no intent to misrepresent any concession by the government in the reply brief. We merely acknowledged they and the district court agree that those conditions do not cover inadvertent use of encryption or cloud computing. And what we said in the reply is that is nice, but that is insufficient. The modern internet requires constant use of SSL encryption. That's the little padlock on your taskbar when you're surfing the internet, and constant use of cloud storage. It is simply not possible to use the internet without those things. And that's why we were seeking that intent requirement. And finally, again, the government talks much about the need to rehabilitate. Mr. Tiedemann, again, has not had a chance to use a monitored device. He would like to go on and be a productive member of society. And he is looking at a 15-year term of supervised release. And this court should follow the Tenth Circuit's lead in Blair, which held that as that term of supervision goes longer, and especially in this case where you have the PO on record saying there will be no device for Mr. Tiedemann in the foreseeable future, that is a greater deprivation of liberty than necessary. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for a decision by the court.